It's good to be with you guys. Hey, open your Bibles if you got them and turn to Matthew chapter 6. Matthew chapter 6, verse 22 and 23. Jesus says this, "The eye is the lamp of the body. So if your eye is healthy, your whole body will be full of light." I want us to like wrestle with this thought from a lot of different angles this morning. And the thought is, how you see shapes what you see. How we see shapes what we see. If your eye is bad, Jesus says, your whole body will be full of darkness. How you see shapes what you see. If then the light in you is darkness, how great is the darkness? Here's something I want to invite you to consider. We say this phrase all the time, right? I'll believe it when I see it, right? It's a nice creed of a skeptic. Maybe it sounds healthy to you. Maybe it's like the kind of convince me spirit that we carry. I'll believe it when I see it. I'll believe it when I see it. But the fact of the matter is, that's a lie. That's a lie. Evidence doesn't convince you. You actually see what you believe. You see what you believe. And it happens all the time. The first way I was introduced to this in a conscious way was in my conversion, which happened like in the midst of the Toronto revival in the Vineyard. And I was watching people get healed and seeing other people that were saying they weren't getting healed. We have like medically verified healings, and you have other people, intelligent people, sophisticated people, rational people that just see it a completely different way. Why? Why? Because how you see shapes what you see. And we've got to realize, I mean, how this affects our own worship, our own wholeness, our own witness, warfare that we navigate. Like, people see what they believe. It's not that the evidence that demands a verdict. People have the verdict that sifts the evidence. That's how we process stuff all the time. Think about the most contentious issues that have happened like in the news in recent days. And you watch the news and you're like, how could somebody see this any other way? The facts are incontrovertibly clear, except to someone else with a different curvature of the lens of their worldview. They see something completely different, and they look at you as if you're just as crazy as you think they are. So how do we navigate that moment? How do we function as faithful followers of Jesus, faithful disciplers of human beings? How do we acknowledge the realities of spiritual warfare in our midst? And all of this as we think about worldview, which seems like the least sexy thing to talk about ever. Like, really? I knew you were a nerd, but now you want to talk to us about worldview? This seems like you've sunk to new levels. Like, when I came to faith, I was like, I had, before I met Jesus, wanted to be a literature professor. I wanted to be a university literature professor and wear tweed jackets and smoke cigarettes. That was my passion in life. And then I met Jesus, and I still wanted to smoke cigarettes. I got rid of the tweed jackets, and I was like, oh, I want to see people transformed into the likeness of Jesus. Like, I want to see people change, and I want to teach biblical theology. And then what I realized is I spent all this energy teaching biblical theology, and I was giving people biblical words, biblical language, biblical axioms, but they didn't have a container shaped in which they could hold these things when trial came. It's like, wait a minute, why are we seeing all these people fall apart? They had the right language. They had the right answers. So the way I've been framing it is like we're raising up people with biblical words, biblical truths, But without a biblical worldview, without a structure in which to hold those things, stuff falls apart when the ship gets rocked. I want us to see the importance of worldview when it comes to our worship, when it comes to our wholeness as human beings. And I mean integrity. Because a lot of us lack integrity. And you get defensive. You're like, I don't tell lies. I don't steal. No, I mean you lack an integrated place in you where like everything's lined up. Your values and your actions and your beliefs and your convictions, where there's a wholeness about them. And that's what I want us to see. So I'm actually more passionate about worldview than I ever fathomed I would be, because I realize if people don't have a biblical worldview, whatever truths we give them are only as stable as the container they're placed in. I think I've told stories about this a couple of times, but I worked in high school at a YMCA baseball complex. I was the field general. I was in charge of maintenance and concessions. It's a really significant job. You should be impressed. But every summer, for about a 3-week stint, we would get these Mormon missionaries that would come to do community service to volunteer there. And what I realized is these guys are like on mission, right? They're riding their bikes and they're going door to door and sharing the truth of Joseph Smith or whatever it is with people. And I would ask them questions and have conversations with them. I was a brand new Christian. I came to faith when I was a sophomore in high school. And I would ask them questions and I realized for almost every issue, they had 3 answers. They had like, they give you their answer and you say, but what about this? And they've got another one under that. And you say, but what about this? And they've got another one under that. But if you ask another question, they completely go blank. They're like, I was only given 3 answers for that point. And you realize beyond that, they weren't given a structure in which to hold their answers, so they didn't have anything comprehensively holding them together. Right? Or to think about it another way, how many of us were raised in moral or Christian culture kind of places, whether you were in a Christian home or not, where you were like given purity culture? And you were told, don't have sex before you get married, which gave rise to all sort of aberrant and degenerate sexual behavior that provided it wasn't sexual intercourse, you had done what you had been told to do, but you didn't understand about the beauty of the human body and why God designs intimacy in the first place and what intimacy between a man and a woman points to and what you're violating once you cross those lines. You weren't given a worldview for your body. You were just told what you could do and what you couldn't do. Gosh, man, I want to see us grow. I want to see us get deep. And in order to do that, I have a bee in my saddle to disciple, or the word that's in my heart all the time is inculcate. I want to inculcate Christian worldview into people, and I want you guys to be zealous about it with me. So let me give you just a couple of introductory pieces. When you think about a worldview, most of us don't even know we have one. And worldview isn't something that you choose. It's something that's imposed upon you. It's absorbed way more than it's adopted. But before you knew you had a choice to have a worldview, you woke up and you had one. This is from Dilthey. I'm going to give you a couple quotes, and I can give you the exact locations of them later if you want. This author says this: worldviews develop under different conditions, climate, races, nationalities. They're determined by history and through political organizations, time-bound confines. They're determined by the time-bound confines of epochs and eras. Worldviews are shaped by all kinds of different stuff. What climate you grew up in shapes how you see the world, and how you see determines what you see, which matters because you're not convinced by evidence. You're sorting evidence based on how you're convinced all the time, all the time. I don't know who's doing a Pro Presenter. Do you have the picture of the woman? This is a famous picture. You guys have seen this. What do you see? You say it out loud. What do you see?
You see
young, beautiful woman looking away. Do any of you guys see an old hag? Do you know why you see which you see? If you're inclined to evaluate images from the top down, you see a young, beautiful woman looking away. If you're inclined to view images from the bottom up, you see an old hag. How you see. Someone just saw her for the first time? You're like, dear God. Yeah. Matt Polk looks at images from the top down. How you see shapes what you see. Right? All the time. Isn't that a trip? And it's not just about your eyes. Your convictions shape the way you process basic data. So think about this. There have been several surveys like this done, but like surveys where people are presented with basic axioms, okay? Here's an axiom. Cotton does not grow in cold, wet climates. England is a cold, wet climate. Does cotton grow in England? Rationalistic people will go, no, doesn't. It's an easy deduction, right? That's because your worldview is rationalistic. There are people that have experiential worldviews that literally on these surveys answer the questions honestly, not being cheeky, not being anything else of like, I've never been to England. I would have no idea how to answer that question. We just told you two premises that you don't have to go to England. You can just sit. I couldn't speak to that. I've never been to England. Because how you see shapes what you see. And by the way, this is one of the reasons why my curiosity just gets the best of me. And I'm so regularly inclined to say to people, when they say something that like lets their worldview show, I'm always like, who told you that? Where did you learn that? When people make a statement about humanity in general, well, I just know that in this situation, people will do X. And I always say, where did you learn that? Who told you that? Where did you get that information? Because now I'm realizing they've shown me a piece of their grid. And it's through that grid that they're processing everything they experience with me, whether that grid is correct or incorrect. I have this chart from Charles Kraft's book on worldviews that's fascinating. He takes worldview assumptions and then talks about how that's manifested in different cultures and how this takes cultural features. He takes something as basic as clothing, right? What do we think about clothes? Well, in some cultures, the cultural assumption is that it's immodest to go naked. America, right? That's why we wear clothes even to bed. There's other cultures that say someone only covers their body with clothing if they're hiding something. So now if I see someone in clothes, I'm making assumptions about you. Not that you're a modest person, but you're a deceitful person. Or think about assumptions we make about commerce and purchasing. If we have a functional like lowest common denominator culture where the thing that matters most is that I get the cheapest price, then I buy stuff online. I don't care about where it came from. I don't consider the components involved in shipping. Where other cultures want to know who they bought it from. It's like, dude, it's just a bar of soap. It doesn't matter. Oh, no, I have a relationship with this person. And because I have a relationship with this person, I can dicker with price. You're like, no, I just click buy now and I do what I do. But that's because you see things through a pragmatic, economic, and consumeristic worldview, whereas other people that have relational worldviews would be willing to pay more for soap because my dad bought soap from this guy. My grandfather bought soap from him. Relationships matter. Your worldview, if you think about it, this is a collection of presuppositions that you're carrying around with you all the time that tell you how things work. Super helpful, but here's where it becomes a problem. Your worldview functions like this lens, but the lens determines how you see, and the lens determines what you see, and it also determines how you interpret what you see. So it's like this lens that shapes both like what your eyes are seeing this way and how you're filtering things coming this way. There's a subtitle of a book I read recently, which, by the way, this book wasn't about worldview. But the subtitle of the book, and it wasn't a Christian book. The subtitle of the book was How Beliefs Become Facts. Well, it shouldn't be that way, right? Facts should become beliefs. This book was about trauma, actually. And how trauma has become lord in a therapeutic culture. And the subtitle of it was How Beliefs Become Facts. I bought it because of the subtitle alone. I was like, that's fascinating. Here's a prime example of we see what we believe. And we live in a moment in which sincerity is our basic epistemological foundation. So if I believe something sincerely, that makes it true. Objectivity doesn't make something true. Sincerity makes it true. Listen to what Alvin Toffler says. Every person carries in his head a mental model of the world, a subjective representation of external reality. James Sire, who I brought his book to show to you guys, I would highly commend this book to you. James Sire writes this book entitled Naming the Elephant, which do you know the pun in the title that he's pointing at? It's a famous story, an illustration has been told dozens of different ways about a little boy who comes home from school and says, Dad, the teacher showed us the globe today. I understand about the earth in the cosmos. But Dad, I don't understand, what's the globe sitting on? Is that like sitting on the back of a turtle? Like this kid's asking cosmological questions. It's like sitting on the back of the turtle, and that satisfies the kid. The kid goes away. The kid comes back the next day. He's like, hey, Dad, I've been thinking about this a lot. What's the turtle standing on? It's like, well, it's resting on a bird. The kid's like, okay, interesting. Goes away and comes back, and comes back again. He's like, hey, Dad, if the earth is resting on the back of a turtle and the turtle's being held up on the shoulders of a bird, what's the bird standing on? It's standing on a giant cosmic elephant, son. Oh, okay. The son's satisfied and he goes away. And he comes back about an hour later and he's like, what's the elephant standing on? And the dad is exhausted and he says, it's elephants all the way down. It's elephants all the way down. Like, stop asking me questions. It's elephants all the way down. But what the father has given the son is a worldview. And so Sire takes that illustration and says, let's name the elephant. How are we actually working to name the elephant? And James Sire, this is what he's dedicated his career to. And he's written good stuff on this. He wrote a book called The Universe Next Door, where he catalogs like all the worldviews that have functioned within history, and then naming the elephant. But Sire says this, and think about this. If how you see shapes what you see, and you see what you believe, Sire says the very concept of worldview itself is worldview dependent. That like to even talk about worldviews is a worldview question. It is the axiom or the adage of, if you want to know how the water is, don't ask the fish. But this is the fish talking about the quality of the water. It is both like frustrating and really, really, really important. So what I want us to consider this morning is like how we, or like how we build a worldview, how we define a worldview. And I want to just give you some exhortations on why I care so much. How we build a worldview, how we define a worldview, and why I care so much. So here is seven questions. This is from Sire's book that I just showed you. Seven questions that form our worldview. I just want you to think about these. Question number one, what is prime reality? Question number two, what is the nature of external reality? Question number three, what is a human being? Question number four, what happens to persons at death? Question number five, why is it possible to know anything at all? Question number six, how do we know what's right and wrong? And question number seven, what's the meaning of human history? These seven questions represent the headings of branches of philosophy, by the way. These are the seven questions that form our worldview. And here's a preview of why I care. The way we answer these questions shapes whether or not we're resilient, shapes the degree to which we can love people, affects the way we navigate disappointment, suffering, crisis, determines if and when and where and whether or not we're generous, determines if we're forgiving people. So think about this. Think about people that are carrying with them the worldview that they absorbed in their birth, and we start talking to them about the truths of the gospel. How do we actually not just get them to agree to the truth of the gospel, but to start to ask how the gospel of Jesus undoes or like jackhammers in some ways and deconstructs their worldview and builds something in its place? I had a conversation with Chad yesterday, and I was kind of vamping on all these things I wanted to talk about with you guys. And Chad, as he can do so kindly and politely, is like, hey, man, like, sounds really fun. It sounds really interesting. Could you actually help me like define the word? And what's fascinating is there are lots of worldview scholars that are making their living writing about worldview and have never supplied a definition for it. And it's like, well, I think I know what you're saying. I'm going to smile and act like I know what you're saying, but I'm not sure if I know what you're saying. I'm going to go over the top. I'm going to give you, in honor of Chad, I'm going to give you three definitions of worldview. Okay, here's number one. This is from James Sire's book. Actually, you get this definition in all the early versions of James Sire's books. Small side story. I worked at Starbucks for several years the first time I was involved in a church plant. And you know, you have your regulars if you worked in a coffee shop. And this guy came in every morning, super kind guy, looked like Papa Smurf, ordered a tall decaf and a cinnamon twist every day. Every day. One day he comes in with a Grove City College sweatshirt on, which is a small evangelical school in Pennsylvania, I think. And I was like, Jim, did you go to Grove City College? And he says, no, I taught there, though. And I was like, really? What's your name? And he said, James Sire. I was like, oh, Jim is James Sire, like the daddy of worldview studies was just nothing but tall decaf and cinnamon twist to me. And I talked with him every day for 2 years. So there it is, my good buddy, Jim. All right, so his original definition is, a worldview is a set of presuppositions or assumptions which we hold consciously or subconsciously about the makeup of our world. Now, the reason why I wanted to give you this definition, even though he has renounced it, not renounced it, he's improved upon it, is he's gotten, for 20 years probably, he got his head kicked in by other guys that get paid to wear tweed jackets and be snide to other people, saying this is insufficient. And the main thing they pressed on is this doesn't talk about desire. This doesn't talk about desire, which if you have that picture of the elephant and the rider, like, man, if you guys have read any of Jonathan Haidt's work, this is one of my controlling passions. Haidt talks about the elephant and the rider, and we live as if we so foolishly believe that we're riding this elephant and we're going this way because we steered the elephant this way, when in fact, the elephant goes wherever it wants. Can you tell that elephant's a pretty large, strong animal? And so what I want to see us do is learn to disciple the elephant and not just disciple the rider. We're talking to heads all the times, rationally, but we're not actually engaging people in the realm of desire. And Sire basically was told, hey, you wrote a worldview definition as if the rider is determining the worldview. But actually, you need to write a worldview definition that encompasses the elephant and the rider. So he gets to that. But let me give you this definition. This is from Koch. Or no, this is from James Olthius. And they're all like Dutch Calvinists that have done this good worldview work, which we can maybe talk about in a second. Here's the second definition. So Chad, you don't just get one, you get two, and then you get a bonus one also. And if you guys want me to share this document with you, I'm really good with craft. I've been mentored by JJ. I can just give you a link. Yes. I see everyone with their cameras. How about I just give you a link to my notes? Will that bless you? So now you can just relax. Point two, definition number two, a worldview or vision of life, which, by the way, people want to make all kinds of issue over even the term worldview. There's reasons why. We're not going to get into them. But this guy's telling you he's smarter than James Sire because he's not just using the word worldview. He's using a vision for life. Is a framework or a set of fundamental beliefs through which we view the world and our calling and future in it. This vision need not be fully articulated. That's important, too, because most of us are operating from fully formed worldviews that we've never spoken out loud. We've never written down. If someone wrote down your worldview on a piece of paper and handed it to you, you might even be offended. You might be like, man, what kind of clown is this? You're like, it's you. It's you. does not have to be fully articulated. It may be so internalized that it goes largely unquestioned. It may not be explicitly developed into a systematic conception of life. It may not be theoretically deepened into a philosophy. It may not even be codified into creedal form. It may be greatly refined through cultural historical development. Nevertheless, this vision is a channel for the ultimate beliefs which give direction and meaning to life. It is the integrative and interpretive framework by which order and disorder are judged. It is the standard by which reality is managed and pursued. This is amazing. It is the set of hinges on which all our everyday thinking and doing turns. Okay, if we don't believe it when we see it, but we see what we believe, here's an even scarier thing. Most of us believe things that we're not aware that we believe. Or we believe things contrary to what we say we believe. Many of us are operating with these worldview realities that are in conflict with what we would read in our Bible, write in our journal, teach in our community group, debate with our unbelieving family members over coffee. But when they get pressed, or when you have to have the game tape of your own beliefs, actions, and decisions played back for you, you start to realize you don't believe what you say you believe, which is why I want to do elephant discipleship at Frontline. I don't want to just disciple brains on sticks, as James K.A. Smith says. I want us to realize that we are desiring beings. So how do we start to exegete the worldview of desire? Here is Sire's refined definition. I would guess this came largely through interaction with me at Starbucks, store 212 in Downers Grove, Illinois. I think I really kind of honed his thinking. And I think this is a great definition for worldview. A worldview is a commitment. And now you see Sire encapsulating desire. A fundamental orientation of the heart that can be expressed as a story or in a set of presuppositions, assumptions which may be true, partially true, or entirely false, which we hold, consciously or subconsciously, consistently or inconsistently, about the basic constitution of reality, and that provides the foundation on which we live and move and have our being. Which, by the way, this definition of worldview serves really as the chapter headings for the second half of this book. I cannot commend this book strongly enough to you. There's lots of books. This is a great one. That's what worldview is. And if you're trying to put like handles on it or put it in a box, Sire in the first edition of this book names seven historical worldviews. And I'll listen to you. You're like, oh, okay. And he unpacks how each one degraded into the next one. Christian theism, deism, naturalism, nihilism, existentialism, pantheistic monism, and then the New Age. And here's what's fascinating. In the second edition of Naming the Elephant, or The Universe Next Door, he added an eighth functional worldview, societally like galvanizing worldview, which was postmodernism. And I would like to encourage you to think on top of that, I'd add two more nuances. This book, let's see when the version of this book was published. Because the world has changed since this was published in 2015. The world has changed. The world, think about what's happened since 2016. So many people talked about how the worldview conversation among academics shifted following 9/11 for a litany of reasons. But think about how the worldview conversations are changing necessarily in the wake of 2016. How many of you have ever heard the term moralistic therapeutic deism? 2005, that was published in a book. And let me give you what the authors of that book, that's Christian Smith and Melinda Denton, in their book Soul Searching, they just give a couple of bullets of like, this is what moralistic therapeutic deism is comprised of, which I think James Sire would say, yeah, that's postmodernism. That's postmodernism in current clothing. But here's what they say shapes this worldview. Belief in a God who remains distant from people's lives. People are supposed to be good to each other, i.e. moral. The universal purpose of life is being happy and feeling good about oneself. There are no absolute moral truths. God allows good people into heaven, and God places very limited demands on people. I would add two things to that. We function in a world of increasing pluralism, and pluralism is called virtuous. Can anyone give me a succinct definition of pluralism? Chad?
We're doing this?
Yeah, let's do it. Now, I wasn't hazing you. I hazed Addison on Sunday, and he wasn't even in the room. It made me really sad. It was a waste of hazing.
Yeah, that there are not, there's not a way, but that there are ways. And all valid.
That's right. So there's not one worldview, is what pluralism says. There are many worldviews, and all of them are valid. Let's pause for a second. Think about the implications on that for a society. Think about the implications on that for a society. Leslie Newbegin wrote a book many, many, many years ago called The Gospel in a Pluralistic Society. How do we preach faithfully when the worldview says there is no worldview? Every worldview is valid. What you see happening, guys, is you see people that will agree to biblical words, theological truths, and then they're not in a container that holds anything. So why is deconstruction such a trope at this point? And I don't say trope to make light of it. These are people we love. Katie and I hung out with a friend from Kansas City, or a couple friends from Kansas City over the last week, and I just heard more stories of like former elders that I've served Jesus with that are like have abandoned the faith and don't even see it's a problem. Like, this is standard fare. There's got to be reasons for that. And it's because we've preached the gospel and discipled people in a world where, even if we haven't talked about it, the operating principle is there is no worldview. There's many worldviews, and all of them are valid. And in fact, it is virtuous for me to hold contradictory worldviews. How do we do that? And I just want you to think about, where are there contradictory worldviews in you? Because there are. That's why I care, by the way. The other thing that I think we've done is we've had the proliferation of pluralism. It's just spread and it's grown, and the implications of it are further. We have a new generation of people that are now raising kids that were raised under the worldview of moralistic therapeutic deism. And we now, to add another kink, and I think Sire would say this is another manifestation of postmodernism, we have now elevated victimhood to a status, a moral status. So, like, I got to find a way to position myself in some mistreated group to make sense of myself in this world today, or to have any status from which to talk. So think about that, and now think about how we talk about the gospel of Jesus to people. And not just how we talk about the gospel of Jesus, but how we see people formed in the ways of Jesus. I love this, man. Eugene Peterson is one of my guys. And in his book, The Ways of Jesus, he said, we've taken John 3:16, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. Is that John 3:16? No, that's John 14:6, forgive me. Got a guy teaching, doesn't even know the Bible. We've taken Jesus' words, wherever they were quoted. Where Jesus says, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. And he says, we've taken it and just tried to make it the truth of Jesus, and we've separated it from the ways of Jesus, and then we wonder why we're not experiencing the life of Jesus. We've taken the gospel, and we've just made it axioms. But Jesus doesn't say, I'm axioms. He says, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. And you can't have the life by separating the truth from the way. So how do we form the ways of Jesus into people even as we preach the truth of Jesus so that we can see people experience the joy and the power of the life of Jesus? That's what I want. That's why I'm doing what I'm doing. I want to see people grow. And I don't want to get tangled up in the crazy language games that you can play with worldview. I just want us like to talk about the basics. I remember I got in a debate with a university professor one time, and I asked him a question. He does this thing with me, and I just looked at him. And I said, well, now you're playing word games with me. And he smiled, and he said, what other kind of game is there? I was like, well, then my life is on the line. This isn't just a word game for me. But here's what I want us to think about. I want us to consider the ways in which we've given pagan stories or symbols explanatory power in our minds. That's not a question I'm going to answer for you. It's a question I'm posing to you. I would love for you to start doing the investigative work for why you believe what you believe. I want you to do the investigative and analytical work of the lenses that you're wearing. I'm going to hurry, Rex, because I know you got to teach too. But I just want to think about this. I want us to think about how our worldview affects our worship. How does our worldview affect our worship? And where are there places where our worldview needs to come into line with the biblical worldview? And where do we need to acknowledge this isn't a sin, it's a fact of existence in a fallen world. We have been discipled according to pagan worldviews. And our affections have been conscripted by pagan worldviews. We have been forcibly taken into armies. And we desire things that are not in line with the word of God, the way of God, the truth of God. And we don't even know it. And we're wondering where there's incongruity with our worship. And it's because, like, well, hey, I'm trying to fit the word of God into a worldview that's not in line with his. Like, man, I'm memorizing more verses? Great. Can we ask God to do the formative work? And Jesus talks about this, by the way. We just churched it up and made it a flannel graph and didn't realize he was talking to us. Like a wise man who builds his house on the rock, he's talking about architectural realities in our souls. Not just like, well, that looked cool when I taught that. I want us to think about our worship. I want us to think about discipleship. And how do we start to disciple not just the truths of Christianity, but the worldview of the Most High God, the one true God? And I mean, in case the lead hasn't been buried, that's why we're in Genesis, right? But I want you guys to have the heads up work to go, oh, wait a minute. What do we need to dismantle? It's one thing to move a couch in someone's bedroom. It's another thing to like remove a wall that's not load bearing. There may be work formation wise that we need to do. It's like, oh, actually, this whole part of your house is built on a fault line that's going to crumble. So how do we name that? Love people, stay connected with them. Rosaria Butterfield, her newest book, like Five Lies of Our Anti-Christian Age, which is a worldview book, by the way. But the last chapter in it is how to stay lovingly connected to friends and family members that disagree with all this with you. That's probably worth the price of the book itself. So think about your worship. Think about your discipleship. I want us to have a framework with which we're encountering and combating the realities of deconstruction around us. There's a reason it's happening. There's a way we can draw near to people in love. There's a way we can disciple our kids and shape our own hearts by God's grace to avoid the kind of cracking that happens when shaking comes. And then I want us to think about worldview issues as a matter of evangelism. There was a dude in Kansas City that I shared the gospel with for years, man, like clearly. And I was really proud of all this cultural work I had done to connect myself to his world, to build a bridge into his world, because that's what a good missionary does, right? And then I realized I'd built a bridge into his world, which philosophically said that everything I believe was relative. It didn't matter. So there was no confrontation. It was just all accommodation of like, I inhabited this guy's world. And that's important work that we need to do. But there was no contending and contesting. It was just all contextualizing. So like when we got to the point, we're like, I think he understood the teaching of Jesus really clearly. He's like, man, you have really been patient with me. You've loved me. You've walked with me for me a long time. Thanks for doing that. So helpful. But I already conceded all the ground of like, well, this means you have to repent. This means you have to abandon your sense-making and all your loves and reorient them around the person of Jesus. He's like, man, this is so helpful. You've been really patient with me. Wow. Turn to one more place in your Bible. I'm almost out of here. Luke chapter 8. It's just another reinforcement. Luke chapter 8. Because what I want us to see is it's all over the Bible. I just didn't see it. Who wants to read Luke 8, the first half, the first words of Luke 8, 18 for us? Chad?
Okay, here we go. Take care then how you hear. For to the one who has, more will be given. And for the one who has not, even what he thinks he has will be taken away.
Read those first six words again.
Take care then how you hear.
What's he saying? How you hear shapes what you hear. How you hear shapes what you hear. Here's an exercise, and this I thought ahead. I didn't think that you guys would care about the other stuff I said as much, but I have a QR code. Are you guys proud of me? You can snap this with your phones. Look at that. JJ, does that minister to your soul? That's a QR code. I made that. If you look really carefully, there's a picture of Josh Curry's face in it. How you see determines what you see. I see Josh Curry. Hey, this gets you an article that Samuel James wrote. Samuel James is kind of my guy. This is kind of funny. Samuel James gets quoted at my dinner table all the time. My wife, who loves him because I love him and won't stop talking about him, and she's read some of his stuff but has a little bit of confusion with Samuel L. Jackson, has been calling him Samuel L. James, and I haven't wanted to correct her until this moment. This is Samuel L. James, if you're Katie Colley, but it's not Samuel L. James. Just Samuel James. He gives 16 words that Christians need to define. Now, this isn't going to form your worldview, but it's going to expose your worldview. And I would invite you to consider, if you define these words, it's going to expose inconsistencies in your worldview, contradictions in your worldview. And I gave you in that thing, I gave you the article that I drew these from, but I'm just going to read these 16 words and then we're going to close in prayer. Think about this, man, and think how these words represent poles that now become like buzzwords and conversations that people aren't even having. They're just weapons that are thrown at people. Wokeness, nationalism, abuse, racism, witness, power, regime, elites, grassroots, therapy, equality, justice, narcissism, conservative, liberal, tribe. Father, help us do hard work to expose the systems of belief that we bear. And triune God, by your grace, would you enable us to submit to your lordship in every possible way? Father, I just ask that you would sanctify completely the minds of every single one of us in this room. Would you sanctify completely the desiring centers of every person in this room? Would you sanctify completely the mouths of every person in this room? Would you sanctify completely the hands and feet of every person in this room? God, would you establish something new in us so that we can see what is very old formed in us? And I want to see more people love you, and I want to see more people withstand the day of testing. And when the fiery ordeals come, I want to see people be cleaner on the other side, not gone. Help us, we ask in Jesus' name. Amen.